Good afternoon, everyone. I suppose you can hear me. I'm sorry that I cannot share the video with you, so I don't have my camera because I have a weak connection. It keeps on reminding me, the machine, that I have a weak internet connection, so I will be only talking to you. And let me know if my voice, for some reason or other, vanishes from the ether. So I had to change this the Zoom format because I'm feeling a bit sick at the moment. So I suddenly got a flu. So let's hope that I'll be able to do this. I didn't want to risk sharing this with you. Okay, so this will be the last lecture from my part, and at the end of the lecture, I will give you instructions about the exam. They are already there, also in the Moodle page, so you can take a look at those and start preparing for the exam, especially for the part of the articles that are listed there to be included to the exam. So each one of you will be randomly given the questions, and there will be also questions regarding the article material in the exam. And on this week, Friday, Olli-Pekka Ruuskanen will be giving two really interesting sessions on banking in general, and for example, about the role of banking in the climate change. So please join us also on Friday for those lectures, because some of the material or parts of these lectures will be included also to the, or his lectures as a complete will be included to the requirements for the exam. Okay, so last week we ended up in my lecture to the discussion about the role of negative demand shocks in terms of what kind of reactions could the central bank do when the economy is facing some kind of demand shock. The natural next step is to take a look at the role of supply shocks. And in that respect, you have to make a distinction between the time dimension of the supply shocks. So you have to be able to separate the temporary supply price shocks from the permanent ones. So the temporary supply shocks have an effect on the short-run aggregate supply curve, but not on the long-run aggregate supply curve at all. And the permanent supply shocks have an effect on the long-run aggregate supply curve. So basically, that refers to a situation where some parts of the productive capacity of the economy is being destroyed completely. That is really a serious situation. So let's start now first from the discussion of these temporary supply shocks. So by definition, it means a shock that involves a restriction in supply. So it has a negative effect on the prices, and it, as a result, increases the commodity prices. So basically, at the moment, we are also in terms of the development of general global economies, we are experiencing basically these kind of temporary supply shocks because, for example, the energy prices are increasing a lot. And for example, some IT products related components prices are increasing a lot because the supply of those components was disturbed during the corona crisis. So we have lots of these kind of things going on in the markets actually at the moment. So it's really a relevant thing to consider. By definition, a temporary positive supply shock means that it is a positive in terms of lowering the inflation rate. And negative thing refers to the case where the inflation rate is increasing. So currently, we are experiencing actually at least fears of negative temporary supply shocks in the global economies at the moment that are basically based on the price development of, for example, energy-related products and energy sectors in general. So when we are talking about the temporary negative supply shock. It means that something in the economy happens that has an effect on the aggregate supply in short term. So the AS1 refers to the short-term aggregate supply curve once again. And there it comes out of sudden, there comes a reason to believe that the general inflation rate might be increasing due to increases, for example, in energy prices. So basically, when we take into account that it's nothing that's related to the aggregate demand is staying at the same level, so we are following we are staying at the same aggregate demand curve. It refers to the case where the aggregate supply is reacting. So there comes a temporary negative supply shock, and that shifts only the aggregate supply. And it will be shifting leftward. So in the new equilibrium situation, we have a situation where the aggregate output will be lower. It goes below the potential level that here in the figure is referred to be at the level of 10. So the real production is here at the level of 9, and the inflation rate is increasing. So the new equilibrium point is here in point 2. So here the new aggregate supply curve in the short term intersects with the previous or the original aggregate demand curve. So it will have an increasing effect on inflation and a decreasing effect on output. So this is obviously something that might happen in the very near future at the aggregate level in global economies due to various reasons. So output will be less than potential, and expected inflation actually has an effect also on the aggregate supply. So aggregate supply will be starting to shift downwards to the lowering expected inflation due to lowering production levels. So this is a chain of events that starts to happen unless we assume that these original changes in the prices are more or less permanent. So the main thing here for you to remember is that this is temporary. There have been lots of discussions in the public media at the moment whether these inflation changes that various institutions are forecasting, they're forecasting probably rising inflation, whether they are temporary or not. If they are temporary, we can expect that due to the effects on the expected inflation, it might be the case that we are able to return back to the original equilibrium point. But if they are not temporary, they are more or less permanent, then we will be experiencing more or less permanently lower production and perhaps also increasing inflation rate for good, or at least more permanently. So that is the key thing that you have to remember, whether these inflation pressures are temporary or are they permanent. Here's a good textbook example about the actual events or actual things that happened in the global economy. This is now for the part of US statistics. So we experienced two periods of oil shocks in the 1970s. Some of you were even born at that time, probably. I was a small boy at that time. But the reasons for the negative supply shocks, which refers once again to the rising inflation in terms of the negativeness. The reasons for that were actually due to these OPEC countries' decisions about cutting the production. So the demand was higher than the production of oil, raw oil, or crude oil and other related products. So it did have an effect on the general equilibrium in the aggregate output and inflation terms. So in the original situation, we were once again here where the demand and aggregate output are at the level of potential production, and the short-term aggregate supply curve and the short-term aggregate demand curve and also long-run aggregate supply curve all intersect. And then based on purely the decisions by the OPEC countries, oil producing countries, the price of oil, crude oil and oil related products started to increase. So it did have an effect on the general price levels quite a lot. So basically in the US data, and this is simply a supply-based inflation peak. It was a short term in terms of the time horizon. It took only about 2 years to return perhaps something that was closer to the original situation in both in oil prices one and oil prices two. The second one was in 1978 until 1980, but nevertheless, it did have real economic effects. And this is the thing that actually economists also at the moment are a bit afraid of. It might be the case that these energy-related hikes, even though they could be short-term, especially if they are longer-term, they are really bad for the general economic development, and we are just surviving from the COVID crisis. So it might be really bad for a real economic development if inflation starts to increase. So basically, in terms of the real figures or numbers for those years, there was really a short-term oil price shock that had a short-term effect on inflation. It did rise from the original level also in the first crisis in 1975 compared to 1973. But in the second crisis, the effects on inflation actually were a bit more permanent. And also the effects on real economic activity were bad in both cases. So unemployment rate decreased due to the lowering aggregate production. So aggregate output decreased and unemployment rate increased. These are the two main real economic indicators that we usually focus on when we take a look at the effects of inflation and want to discuss those in terms of the real economic development. We take a look at the GDP development, which refers to the aggregate output or unemployment rate. When GDP goes down, unemployment rate goes up and vice versa. So it was really bad for real activity, and it might be the case that we are seeing something of a kind also this time. So I think that it will be the case that the central bank will have to also consider once again the balance between stabilizing real economic activity, deviations from the potential level, and deviations of inflation from the target level, when they take a look at the near-term actions in terms of monetary policy, when they start to observe that the inflation rate is increasing due to the changes in the prices of the energy sector. So this is really something that might be happening also in the very near term. Then we have this school of real business cycle theorists that has originated from Edward Prescott at the Arizona State University, that believe that business cycle fluctuations are completely dependent on the permanent supply shocks and nothing else matters basically. So if there's a permanent negative supply shock, such as increasing ill-advised regulations or a permanent disruption of productive capacity, like, for example, during the natural disasters, that causes the economy to be less efficient. It will reduce in supply, and that would decrease the potential output. So that is the key thing there, that the long-term potential output will decrease. Hence, the long-run aggregate supply curve in that previous figure would shift to the left and permanently. So that is a big problem, really big problem. And these RBC, real business cycle theorists, actually, they advocate that these are actually causes for also the short-term fluctuations in real economic activity. It's a bit questionable whether it is actually the case, but this is one of the schools that economics as a discipline is very famous of. So basically, in terms of these figures that we have been discussing here, the permanent negative supply shock refers to this kind of situation. So let's assume that there is a natural disaster, for example, that destroys production possibilities for good. So that will be having an effect on the position of the long run aggregate supply curve. So there's a permanent negative supply shock that changes the position of long run aggregate supply to left, and also the short term aggregate supply starts to react, obviously. So the economy will start shifting to this direction in terms of the equilibrium. We once again assume that aggregate demand related factors are not changing. So the aggregate demand curve remains the same as it has been. So the new equilibrium points are completely determined by the intersection points between the aggregate supply in short-term analysis with the aggregate demand curve, and in long-term analysis also from the intersection of the new long-run aggregate supply curve with the demand curve. So basically, these real business cycle theorists want to argue that the economy will return to long-run equilibrium with output permanently lower and inflation permanently higher. So basically, this is really, really a bad situation in terms of the economy. So everything that has an effect on the productive capacity of the economy should be advanced. So basically, you should do all your actions in terms of preserving the productive capacity in the economy. So basically, as examples, once again, about these supply shocks, we have now discussed only the negative supply shocks because we might be experiencing these kind of things in the very near future. But obviously, the other side of the coin are these positive supply shocks. Positiveness means positiveness in terms of the development of production. Once again, that should be increasing when we experience positive situation. And in terms of the inflation rate, we are talking about the lower inflation, because the lower is the inflation in long-run terms, unless it goes too low, the more is the situation, the better is the situation in that sense. So here we have an example of positive supply shocks that were related to the events or development, once again, in the US economy. From the economic history, we can say that at the mid-1990s in the US economy, the healthcare costs at the aggregate level declined. And there was also a rise in productivity from the computer revolution that was perhaps at the, let's say, most active or best situation in terms of the new inventions that were made at the IT sector. It was there in 1995-1999 around. So that led to a rightward shift in the long-run aggregate supply curve. So production possibilities in that sense regarding the potential levels of production improved. So it was a good thing. So we moved from the original situation of long-run aggregate supply curve that originally intersected the aggregate demand curve and aggregate supply curve in short run here, in point one. We moved to the new point where inflation was lower and the potential production was higher. So that led to a permanent rise in output and a permanent decrease in inflation. So things that have an effect on the productivity are the ones that have an effect on the position of the long-run aggregate supply. Computer revolution increases all kinds of productivity, not just capital productivity, but also labor productivity, and the better healthcare and lower costs related to healthcare improves, especially the labor productivity. So there were actually at least these two reasons as a background for changing this long-run aggregate supply curve. And we see from these actual data that inflation actually went down during 1995-1999, a bit, not very much, but a bit, and unemployment rate decreased. So this is basically referring to the level of structural unemployment in the US economy. More or less full unemployment situation in terms of cyclical unemployment development. So basically this around 4% level can be denoted to be kind of a natural rate of unemployment in the US economy. So we can draw conclusions now based on this aggregate demand and aggregate supply analysis in view of the real business cycles theory, at least. So according to these guys, there, if there's a shift in the aggregate demand curve, it will have an effect on output only in the short run and has no effect in the long run. If there's a permanent temporary supply shock, it will affect output and inflation only in the short run, but it has no effect in the long run. And once again, remember that we are always assuming here that nothing happens with respect to the key factors that have an effect on the aggregate demand curve. So nothing related to, for example, expectations or the outlooks for the firm sector regarding the investment willingness is changing here. So a permanent supply shock affects output and inflation both in the short and long run. And economy has this kind of self-correction mechanism that gets it to the potential output level and natural rate of unemployment over time. And these numbers here actually refer to the case that in the US economy, it actually might be relevant to assume that some kind of long-term natural level of inflation would be around 2% or below 2.5 at least, and the long-term natural rate of unemployment could be around 4.2 or something like that, based on these fairly short-term figures here from a period of 5 years. So basically, when we want to analyze this supply and demand effects or changes in the market conditions around the global financial crisis from 2007 and 2009, we have to remember that when we started the global financial crisis started, we had the situation where at the beginning of 2007, there was really high demand, once again, high demand for oil. And that was especially in developing countries like China and India. Once again, we have this also. We have observed this, that the demand for oil has increased in China and India quite a lot this year. And along with that, there was also a slowing production, for example, in Mexico, Russia, Nigeria for the part of oil. So oil price was really high. And it is also now the same situation. So this is a good reason for a negative supply shock at the aggregate level. So we are experiencing basically this kind of same situation at the moment once again. So based on this ground, we actually observed a negative supply shock at the aggregate level based on this energy market situation that shifted the aggregate supply curve upward, and a negative demand shock that originated actually from the financial markets. So basically, we also had the situation where the financial crisis introduced an effect also on the real economic activity, because it was a banking crisis. It was not just a stock market originated speculative crisis. It was a real thing. It did have an effect on banks. They collapsed, and it was a global chain of events. So when the collapse started in the US markets, US banking sector, also the European markets, and also some of the Chinese banks followed this same path. So it really had due to this increase in financial frictions. So that small case F letter in our previous notions regarding the factors that have an effect on the real investment behavior of firms, that F increased. So financial frictions increased. So it did also have an effect on the aggregate demand. So the change in the aggregate demand was due to those things. But originally, their starting point was the change in the aggregate supply conditions due to the energy prices. So they led to an increase in inflation and a decline in output. And the financial crisis started to develop also at the same time. So it started to shift also the aggregate demand curve. So it started to shift leftward as the aggregate supply curve also is shifted upwards. And it then had an effect on the aggregate supply curve, actually. So aggregate demand shifted left because the financial crisis started to deepen, because the news started to spread that it will be really a real economic crisis. So it did have an effect on the production. And it also shifted the aggregate supply curve down because production changed. There was due to the slack in the demand. So it led actually to the situation where there were further decline in output and a fall in inflation, actually. So we ended up this kind of slump situation of lowering prices at the general level and lowering production. So inflation went really down, actually, due to this, when we experienced both a supply shock and a demand shock. Basically, this kind of situation was experienced also very short term during the corona crisis. Both the supply and demand reacted at the aggregate level to the closing of the economies in global terms. But this shock period seems to be lasting clearly shorter period of time compared to the global financial crisis. At least it seems to be like that at the moment. But I think that actually these inflation fears are something that might disturb this development in the near future. We just have to hope that these inflation pressures, they are not permanent, and inflation due to the changes in really sudden and strong changes in energy prices, the effects of those are not permanent in terms of the inflation. But nevertheless, in terms of the real economic aggregate data in the US economy, inflation declined quite a lot during a 3 years period of time, or 4 years, and unemployment rose a lot. So this can happen if everything goes wrong, basically both on the supply side and on the demand side of the economy. So obviously a central bank has to probably react on these kind of things, and they reacted. They tried to prevent these collapses as much as possible, especially in terms of the collapse in the real economic activity. Here we have, in the next slide, we have the same events actually in the UK financial crisis also. So there was also a negative supply shock that shifted the aggregate supply curve upwards and increasing the inflation and reducing the output. Once again, the main reason for that were the rising oil prices. And then there was also this change in the position of the aggregate demand curve. A negative demand shock shifted that aggregate demand leftwards, while once again also the aggregate supply shifted down as oil prices started to fall due to the lowering aggregate demand and crisis in the financial markets. So that led actually to a situation where we experienced also, perhaps in a milder, not so strongly, but we also saw a decrease at the end of the day when comparing the starting period of 2006 to the 2009 situation inflation rate in the UK data was a bit lower than at the origin of the crisis, but the unemployment rate increased. So basically, this is what happened in the UK, but what happened in the China? The Chinese case is a bit different. Like it has in the most recent history, it has always been a bit different due to the very strong role of government. But also in China, the origins of the things that started to have an effect on the real economic situation were the negative effects from the global demand towards Chinese products. So there was a negative demand shock that shifted the aggregate demand leftwards. It started to decrease output and it started to lower inflation. But in the Chinese case, there was a right at the beginning of the crisis, there was a huge, in 2007 already, there was a huge fiscal stimulus package. So fiscal policies were used. They run into more debt for the part of government sector and run into more deficit. So they used huge fiscal stimulus package and also monetary policy actions, autonomous easing of monetary policy that actually changed the position of aggregate demand quickly back to the original situation. So the government did all its possible actions to prevent the collapse in the real economic activity. So basically, the inflation, yes, it also first it started to increase, but then it decreased until the end of 2009, actually to a situation of deflation. So the aggregate prices started to actually lower in China already in 2009. But the main thing here is that the output growth, they were able to save the output growth. So the growth rate remained actually pretty much at the same level at the end of or during 2009 compared to the starting values of 2006 or 2007. They experienced an alarming period when also the Western countries were really, really worried about the situation with China because growth rates were only at the level of 4.4%. And in terms of the most recent economic historical data from China, this is really a low percent value. But actually, we are now also experiencing kind of a situation where the Chinese growth has decreased quite a lot. So China is not the sort of a locomotive of growth in the global economy anymore so much, perhaps. But nevertheless, this sort of emphasizes the strong role of government in China. So even without speaking anything about unconventional monetary policy actions, the Chinese government was able to both use the Bank of China, People's Bank of China, so monetary policy actions, its balance sheet, and the loosening monetary policy action, lowering of interest rates, to enhance the economic activity. And together with that, they were able to use huge fiscal stimulus packages that more or less saved the economy in a very short term. So this was completely different reaah compared to the Western economies. It's interesting to see what will happen in the near future. The position of China has perhaps a bit changed. People are claiming that it's a general belief that the origins of corona crisis were in China. It remains to be seen what we are experiencing in the next couple of years. Will something else come from there? These prices in energy prices are now really an alarming thing at the moment. And they concern also the Chinese economy. One of the reasons is that China and India are heavy users of coal and coal-related production of energy. So that is really something that now is increasing also the demand for oil. And the oil demand has increased also in other countries due to the revival of the economies from the corona crisis. So we will be seeing we'll be experiencing really interesting, let's say, a couple of months or 6 months period, whether these rises in energy prices start to sort of realize in terms of prices also in the general inflation rate. Well, that is something that actually you should be able to analyze based on these long run and short run aggregate supply and demand curve analysis, whether there will be effects and what kind of effects are going to be in terms of the real economic activity. The final thing here in this course for my part is the discussion of this Phillips curve idea. That is actually a discussion about how to actually bring this idea of aggregate supply curve perhaps to a more relevant context in terms of discussing also about the effects of, for example, monetary policy on unemployment. Because unemployment is the thing that is very bad for general economic activity and also in terms of the income distribution discussions and development of nations in general. So this is also originally an empirical finding. Phillips is one of the famous economists that also was very much interested in doing always data-related things, empirical things. And he found actually that in the data from 1950s, actually, there is a negative relationship between unemployment and inflation. The idea behind that is very intuitive because when labor markets are tight, it means that there is more demand than there is supply for the labor. So labor input is tight. So obviously that will have an effect on the price of the labor that is referring to the wages. So when the unemployment is low, there's more demand than there is supply, it might be that actually firms are facing difficulties in hiring qualified workers. And it may even have a hard time keeping their current workers in place. So because of this shortage of workers in the labor market, they will raise wages to attract them. So they need to have those workers in production processes, and they raise the prices actually at a more rapid rate. So is there really an empirical relationship that is negative between inflation and unemployment rate? In the data from 1950s until 1969, in the US case, there really seems to be this negative relationship. So when the inflation has been high, it has been referring to the low unemployment rate. And when the unemployment rate has been high, it has been in connection also to a low inflation rate. So there's a negative relationship. But in the data after 1970s, it has actually vanished. If you take a look at this panel B, this figure here, it's actually something that has vanished. After 1970s, there's no, at least no negative relationship between these two variables, economic variables, inflation rate and unemployment rate. If nothing, it might actually be even positive, but nevertheless, it's not at least negative. So what are the reasons for the vanishment of this Phillips relationship? First of all, it might be really relevant that expectations do have a role there. First, and then secondly, it might be really relevant to make a distinction between the short and long-run Phillips curves. Once again, like we have made the distinction between the short-run aggregate supply curve and long-run aggregate supply curve, it might be relevant to also consider long-run Phillips curve and short-run Phillips curve. So, for the discussion of these, let's assume first that there's a decrease in the unemployment rate. In good economic conditions, production changes are favorable. So the GDP is increasing. There's a decrease in the unemployment rate. That will lead to the movement along the short-term Phillips curve. So it will be raising the inflation rate. Basically, because unemployment, the lower is the unemployment rate, the higher is the inflation rate, if we think this in terms of the original Phillips curve. But since the inflation rate increases, it will also have an effect on the expected inflation. The higher the inflation rate, the higher will probably also be the expected inflation rate, because we usually observe that the expectations in inflation are self-fulfilling, basically. So if we observe high inflation, there's probably more, it's more probable that we will be also observing increasing inflation in the future than observing decreasing inflation, unless the policymakers do something. So expected inflation rises, and it will be shifting the Phillips curve in short term, once again upwards, until the Phillips curve reaches the point of 3, where unemployment rate is at the natural rate of unemployment. And here we are actually referring to a situation where the unemployment rate is something below 4%, basically, and we will be ending up to a long-run situation. Unemployment rate at the natural rate of unemployment is around 5%, so the inflation rate that is in connection to the natural rate of unemployment is 10% in these examples. So you have to make a distinction between the short-run Phillips curve and long-run Phillips curve. And there, the expected inflation or expectations regarding the future development of inflation have a role to play. So we have 3 important conclusions with respect to this Phillips curve analysis. There's basically no long-run trade-off between unemployment and inflation. We will always end up, in the long-run terms, we will end up into a situation of natural values for this. But there is a short-run trade-off between unemployment and inflation. And you have to make a distinction between the short-run and long-run forms of the Phillips curves. So in practical terms, what has happened in the real data? For example, in the US case, expectations augmented Phillips curve is actually the one that might have been working in the data after the 1970s, because we observed, for example, these 2 oil crises, oil price crisis periods starting from 1973 and 1978, actually. The highest peaks in oil prices were observed there in 1973 and 1979. And these Phillips curve theorists actually realized that they have to add one more sort of a distinction feature to the expectations augmented Phillips curve. So the shocks that originate from the supply of inputs, input prices, they are shocks to the supply that change the amount of output in an economy, and they can produce these kind of results from for the observed data. So they actually, the shocks are really important. And once again, we are experiencing this actually, that shocks might be really important in terms of having effect on the inflation, and also the relationship between inflation and real economic activity, i.e. unemployment rate. So the modern Phillips curve actually nowadays includes also in some form or other the past observations of actual inflation. So we are talking about the adaptive form of the Phillips curve. So we have both the expected values for the inflation, and we have also the past development of inflation in the modeling of the Phillips curve. So we need to understand how the firms and households form their expectations about inflation. And one very simple model is based on these kind of AR autoregressive models that are simply based on the past history of the inflation. So in economics literature, we refer in this case to the adaptive expectations or backward-looking expectations formation. So we just take a look at the previous data and assume that there are no strong changes in the current observations with respect to the previous ones. So it's a smoothly changing time series. But obviously, once again, this kind of skips the role of shocks, sudden shocks that might have an effect on the general inflation rate. But basically, we can use these ideas of Phillips curve thinking to formulate the modern version of aggregate supply curves. So in order to complete this aggregate demand and supply discussion that we have been doing here, we just need to use this Phillips curve representation to derive the short-term aggregate supply curve. So then we are able to represent the relationship between total quantity of output that firms are willing to produce and the inflation rate. And we can translate that to the Phillips type representation by replacing the unemployment gap with the output gap. So basically, when we start from the discussions that are related to, for example, monetary policy actions that are based on using Taylor rule kind of things, we can basically replace in the Taylor rule the deviations of actual output from the potential output with the deviations of unemployment from the natural rate of unemployment. So basically, we can do also the analysis about functioning of Taylor rules by using these unemployment rate data. Okay, so obviously it's natural to further do the discussions about the role of Phillips curve also in terms of the variables that are in connection to the monetary policy actions. So how do the monetary policy actions react to these kind of shocks? Main idea here for you is to remember that always it is the target for the monetary policy makers to try to minimize the difference between inflation and the inflation target. So that's the main aim in their actions. And it will we also in the near future, even though we are discussing very much about the role of climate change, the things that sort of materialize that are relevant in the discussions regarding the climate change actually materialize to the effects on the inflation or prices. So basically, this price target or stabilization of the inflation is actually a relevant thing also in the future for the monetary policymakers. So basically, this kind of analysis that we have been discussing here can be done also. They should be. You can do those also in the future. So when we are discussing about both the demand shocks and permanent supply shocks, it's obvious that policymakers can simultaneously try to get the price stability and try to stabilize the economic activity. If there's a temporary supply shock, they can achieve either price stability or economic activity stability, not both. So they have to, in short-term policy respects, they have to be able to make the decision between the trade-off of these two. So it is really a difficult job for central banks. They have been trying to do this based on the sort of a conventional monetary policy actions, but already for many years, it has not been possible to do without unconventional monetary policy actions. So we have already lost kind of the interest rate weapon in these stability or stabilization activities for the part of monetary policy actions. So if there is a change or shock in the aggregate demand, they can respond to this by two ways. So they can choose not to respond anything, let the markets do their process there freely. So they don't want to intervene at all. But the other possibility is obviously that they want to stabilize the economic activity and inflation also in the short run. So this gives a reason for using the Taylor rule type sort of decision rules for the actions regarding. So they have, you obviously have to measure the development of realgamic activity with respect to the potential level and also the development of actual inflation with respect to the target. And whether there are deviations with either of these, then make policy reactions. If there are aggregate demand shocks, there's no trade-off between the percent of price stability and economic activity stability, basically. So this is the main thing here. So if there is a demand shock and the central bank decides that it will not be reacting to this kind of thing, then aggregate demand, for example, in this case, shifts leftwards. So basically, we have a negative situation here. So the production changes, we have a negative demand shock. So we go from the 0.1 to 0.2. And that is referring to the original aggregate supply situation. So production will be below the potential level now. We have Y2 referring to the level of production and Pi2 referring to the inflation rate. So that will have an effect on the aggregate supply curve. So aggregate supply, because the demand has decreased, the aggregate supply will start to react to that. It will come down. So it will go to the 0.3, where we have once again the situation where aggregate production is at the potential level, but we will observe a lower rate of inflation. This is the thing that happens when there is no reactions from the side of policymakers. So there's no policy response to this thing. But if there is a policy response, then when the aggregate demand curve starts to shift leftward, the central bank starts to react to this. It will cut the real rate of interest at any level of inflation. So it will be having an effect on one component, especially in the aggregate demand, and that is the real investment behavior of the firms. So it will be increasing, hence the aggregate demand curve will also be changing its position to the long run equilibrium back again. And the inflation is also stabilized at the target inflation level in this case. But this requires the decision from the policymakers that you are willing to react on this thing. But if there is a permanent change on the other side of the coin, so if there is a permanent change in the supply, there are also, in that case, there are two possible choices for the central bankers. There's no policy response, or there is the attempt to try to stabilize the inflation, because the supply will have an effect on especially inflation, the supply shocks. So if there is a permanent supply shock, so basically in the first step, there's a negative supply shock that shifts the long run aggregate supply curve leftward. It's a permanent thing, so it will have an effect on the position of long run aggregate supply curve. So the potential production will permanently go lower. It will have an effect on the short term things also. So it will have an effect on the short-run aggregate supply curve. It will start shifting upwards. And because the demand has also changed, or the equilibrium amount of production has changed. So basically, in the step three, the economy will start to develop or go towards the new equilibrium. So it returns to the long-run equilibrium ultimately, with output falling and inflation rising. So there's a permanent slack in the supply conditions. There is not enough supply to meet the demand. And the central bank is not reacting to that. Obviously, this is not a good thing for the economy, because your production has decreased permanently. And alongside with that, you have higher inflation. So it's not a good thing. Usually, central banks don't allow these kind of things to happen. So if they have, as the modern central banks nowadays have, they have this policy that aims to stabilize the development of inflation. Once again, there's this originally this permanent negative supply shock that has an effect on the long run aggregate supply curve. It will go leftward. It will be having an effect also on the short-run aggregate supply curve. So that will obviously also, because the long-run curve has changed, it will have an effect also on the short-run supply. And when the central bank decides to react on this bad development in the economy, they will loosen the monetary policy. They will try to hinder the inflation development, so they will be using tightening monetary policy because inflation pressures are increasing, so they will be using tightening monetary policy actions to have an effect on the aggregate demand. So obviously, they will affect on the through the effects on the real interest rate, so they will try to raise nominal interest rates more than there are inflation pressures, so it will be having an effect on the real interest rate that will rise. So it will be a tightening aggregate demand effect through the effects on the real investments of the firm sector, and it will be having an effect on the inflation rate so that it will be lowering the future inflation rate. So the economy returns to long-run equilibrium with inflation stabilized at this target level of pi t. That is the thing that happens when the central bank wants to react to this permanent supply shock. Obviously, it's not a good thing, once again, for the production, because it will have a tightening effect on the demand also. So basically, the central bank is emphasizing the role of inflation target here in favor of the target for real economic activity, because it's willing to sacrifice quite a lot, actually, about real economic activity in terms of stabilizing the inflation development. And there might be pressures for the central bankers to be political pressures to be changed in this case. And in some cases, for example, in the U.S. economy, when these kind of developments have been seen there, the presidents have changed the central bank chairmen of the central banks for the purpose of changing the policy perspective also. So this is the reaction of the central bank when it has this aim of stabilization of inflation, and when there comes this permanent supply shock. Let's see what happens in the near future, both in the ECB and also in the US economy, because inflation pressures are really increasing in the US economy especially, but they are also increasing in the European economy. So what will happen there in terms of the near-term monetary policy actions is a big question mark at the moment. Will the central bank start to react on these inflation pressures or not? If they start and they tighten the monetary policy, so that is actually referring to withdrawal of these purchase programs, first of all. It might be sudden and very strong withdrawal of these unconventional monetary policy actions. And then after that, they will start the increase of interest rates, actually. And it remains to be seen what is the effect on the real economic activity. It might be the case that the central banks are actually loosening more these very tight inflation targets that they have had in the most recent years, for the sake of enhancing the real economic development in the future. So if there is a temporary supply shock that is actually not so serious thing, they face a short-run trade-off between stabilizing the inflation and economic activity. So this is not so bad thing actually at all. And monetary policymakers can respond to the temporary supply shock in three possible ways. There's no response, or they can try to stabilize inflation, or they can try to stabilize the economic activity. But basically, in short-term analysis, they cannot basically do both of these at the same time. If there is a, so in terms of these figures, if there's a temporary change in the aggregate supply and there's no policy response, the chain of events goes like this, that there's first a change in the position of the aggregate supply curve. It shifts upwards once again, and it will temporarily be increasing the inflation and decreasing output, and inflation and economic activity will stabilize nevertheless in the long run. There's no policy response in this case. If there is a short-run aim to stabilize the inflation for the part of central bank, then once again, we see first this temporary negative supply shock that shifts the aggregate supply curve upwards. Then the second stage, there is this autonomous tightening of monetary policy, assuming that the central banks want to react to these increased inflation pressures. It means that they will be tightening once again the monetary policy. So in terms of the ideas in the Taylor rule, they will be increasing the nominal interest rate more than there are these inflation pressures. So basically, the real interest rate will increase. And that is the relevant thing that has an effect on real investment behavior of the firm sector. So the aggregate demand curve will start to shift. It will go to the position 83. And it will lead to a decline in output because the investment demand of the firm sector will decline. But it will have the inflation as a result. The central bank will get to its target of inflation rate. So inflation will be kept at the target level. Short-term aggregate supply curve will shift also to downwards, and it will lead policymakers to autonomously ease monetary policy to shift the aggregate demand curve back to 81. And that will stabilize the inflation and output in the long run. So there's short-term inflation stabilization, but that will have also the effects on the long-run situation. So in the long-run term, we will be able to get back to the original situation where we have this started from this IT and potential production level. If there is a change in the, so this is actually the thing that we actually were discussing here. So if there's the discussion about the stabilization of inflation and stabilization of economic activity, we can make these three main conclusions based on this. If most of the shocks are at the aggregate level are to the aggregate demand, or they are permanent aggregate supply shocks, then the policymakers that stabilize inflation will also stabilize economic activity, even in the short run. So this basically follows the real business cycle theorists' ideas. If the temporary supply shocks are more common, then the central bank must choose between the two stabilization objectives in the short run. In the long run, there's no conflict between stabilizing inflation and economic activity in response to the shocks. Now, once again, we have to remind us here that this is referring to the situation when the interest rate tool is the thing that we can actually use. In the conditions of unconventional monetary policy situation where we have hit the lower bound of nominal interest rate at the zero level, or we have gone even to the negative side, these things change a bit. And in the rest of the slides that we are not able to go through here, you will get an idea about these things, how things start to change when we go towards the zero lower bounds and also below that. It will be having an effect on the slope of the monetary policy curve and also the form of the aggregate demand curves. So basically, you can take a discussion about these unconventional monetary policy effects using those ideas, but nevertheless, these discussions regarding the effects of changes in interest rates for the part of monetary policy actions are relevant because now we are already facing a situation when there are discussions about the changes in the interest rates or the main steering rates of the central banks. So in all these discussions, it's always relevant to remember that actually inflation is always and everywhere monetary phenomenon, basically. So we can support this idea based on these aggregate demand and supply analysis because it shows that the monetary policymakers can target any inflation rate in the long run, but by shifting the aggregate demand curve with autonomous monetary policy. So it gives a big role to the changes in the interest rates. And the interest rates are, they have been noted to be relevant actually still in the negative side after the unconventional monetary policy actions have been withdrawn a bit. So basically there are some studies that have also noted this that the interest rates in the monetary policy tool set are really important. So if there is a rise in the inflation target that actually is a relevant thing at the moment, it might be actually only optimal for the central banks to change their inflation target, not to have that at the fixed 2% level as they now have. So basically, if there is a rise in this inflation target, then it gives a reason for the monetary policymakers to loosen the monetary policy. So it will allow them to lower the interest rates if they are facing real economic problems in the economy. So it will shift the aggregate demand curve to the right. And over time, the short-run aggregate supply curve starts to react and it will start to go leftwards. And the end result is the situation where we end up into the new target level of inflation at the potential level of production. So this is basically something that the markets are allowed to do when the central bank policymakers are willing to skip or loosen the inflation target, which means that they are willing to increase the target for the level of inflation. And this is something that is actually currently discussed quite a lot. For example, in the discussions of IMF, also within the OECD countries, whether it is relevant to actually loosen this inflation target due to the increasing inflation pressures that are more or less something that the policymakers cannot do anything because they are based on these slacks in the supply chains. And they are based on the rises in energy prices. So energy prices are giving a much more emphasis in these discussions nowadays. And they are really relevant thing at the moment. So in that case, it might actually be only sort of intuitively actually a nice thing for the central banks to skip or give up a bit about their very tight inflation targets at the moment. So we can obviously always talk about these inflationary monetary policy things when we skip this kind of inflation target. But in those discussions, we always have to make a distinction about the role of sources for the inflation rate or the higher inflation rate, whether it comes from the cost side, production side or supply side. We are talking about the things that have an effect on the aggregate supply curves in our discussions or presentation here. So we are talking about cost push inflation in the case where the rising inflation results from temporary negative supply shocks or push by workers for wage hikes beyond what productivity gains can justify. So basically, these are things that you always have to, as a policymaker, you have to always consider whether we are talking about pressures that come from the cost side or the supply side, or whether we are talking about demand side things that have an effect on inflation. So demand pull inflation results from policymakers pursuing policies that increase aggregate demand. So as a policymaker, you have to always be aware of what is the general situation in the aggregate supply and aggregate demand conditions in the markets, in case you engage into political decisions about monetary policy, for example. So in case of cost push situation, we have this kind of case where a temporary negative supply shock shifts the wrong short-run aggregate supply curve upwards. And it will cause then, at the next step, it will cause the output to fall and unemployment start to increase. So we are moving to this situation. Policymakers react to this original shock, that is the shock regarding the aggregate demand, aggregate supply. So they increase aggregate demand in response to this. So they will be shifting the position of the aggregate demand. And once again, we are here in the new position. And then we are facing the original points here once again with the supply. So these keep on shifting basically upwards. So both of these curves keep on shifting upwards. So if there's a cost push inflation, it usually ends up into a situation where the inflation is de facto terms, it's higher in longer term equilibrium point two. So this is the case where the policymakers want to react. So they have an effect on the position of aggregate demand also. So they are basically pursuing towards a situation where the inflation is higher for the sake of restoring the real economic activity that would otherwise lower if they are not reacting based on the items in the aggregate demand. In the other case, when there's this demand pull, so the things that first happens is the change in the aggregate demand. So policymakers, for some reason or other, they are new policymakers, for example, they want to sort of give good groundings for their choice, that they are the policymakers at the moment, so they will be increasing aggregate demand to reach a higher output target, and that will have an effect also on the aggregate supply. It will cause the short-run aggregate supplies to start shift upwards in response to these rising wages that come due to the increases in the demand, because demand is higher than supply originally, so the prices start to increase, and also the labor markets get to be tight. So there's more demand for the products, so there's also more demand for the production inputs, so there's more demand for labor market input, so their wages start to rise. Due to this, and in addition to the effects on the expected values for inflation, actually, that play a role here, since the wages start to increase, it will be leading to a kind of a vicious circle of inflation development. So it will be leading to a spiraling rise in inflation, actually. So basically, this is the situation, once again, referring to the case where we allow the change in the inflation, increasing levels of inflation. So it's about basically doing these decisions based on the political agendas. And this is actually one of the reasons why it's really difficult at the moment to make a clear distinction between these fiscal policy discussions and monetary policy discussions, because the government level policymakers are basically doing their decisions regarding the aggregate demand components. Whereas for the part of aggregate supply, the policy decisions should be made by the central bankers, perhaps. So basically, now that we are living this period of unconventional monetary policy actions, these things are mixed, because in terms of funding the government budget that is related to this, increasing, for example, government spending through the purchases of the central banks towards the central government assets. We are now financing also this. The central bank is now financing this fiscal policy actions. So now we are these two sort of these two guys here, they are more or less mixed at the moment. So there are lots of things going on. So it's really difficult to make these kind of analysis using these standard figures. And for that, I encourage you to take a look at a couple of slides here that sort of give you an idea on whether it is possible at all to use these kind of aggregate supply and aggregate demand analysis to analyze these unconventional monetary policy actions for the part of the role of quantitative easing and playing at the zero lower bound level of interest rates by the central bank. So the rest of the slides that are being given here in the lectures give you an idea about those things in view of these aggregate supply and aggregate demand curves. But these discussions actually are now, or these models are now developing quite a lot. They are not at the textbook levels yet, not even at the published article levels yet. So basically the mix up of this fiscal policy and monetary policy actions to a same sort of a scenario or this kind of modeling framework is just going on. So take a look at these things in view of the current understanding using these aggregate supply and aggregate demand curves. Read those slides also when you start to prepare for the exam. So basically, this is the ending point for my lectures. And next, I would like to show you the exam instructions. So I will try to open this. Can you see this PDF slide 9 now? I suppose you can see this. So this is now also available in Moodle. And here are the instructions. The first thing for you to remember is to sign up for the exam in SISU. I was, our study secretary pointed this to me because it will be impossible for you to take the exam if you have not signed up for that in SISU.
Excuse me, but we cannot see the PDF, or at least I cannot.
Okay, you cannot see. Okay, well, I'll start. I try to share it once again. Can you see it now?
Yes, now we can see it. Thanks.
Okay, so I have here these points or the notes for you to. So remember first to sign up in SISU, and then the actual conduct of the exam is that you have the 60 minutes to do the exam, but you can take it between 8 a.m., 8 p.m. on these 2 days. So the first one is on 5th November, and the second one is on 19th November. And nevertheless, the deadline for the home assignment submission is 26th. Some of you have already asked whether it is possible to submit the home assignments earlier. If you want to submit those earlier and get the grades before this deadline for the home assignments, then send me an email that you want to get. Some of you might be graduating or something like that, or some other for some other reasons want to have the result as soon as possible. So send me an email if you want to have those results before the 20. I will be grading all the submissions starting from the 29th of November, so on Monday, the next Monday after the submission deadline. I can give you, for those of you, the grades also a bit earlier. I will give you the final points from the weekly quizzes next at the beginning of next week. So you can also sort of prepare for your exam in view of the additional points that you have already obtained from the weekly quizzes. But nevertheless, for the passing of the course, obviously you have to first pass the exam. But if you have passed the exam, here are the effects actually for the regarding the weekly quizzes, for example. So obviously the home assignments have a very big role. If you do well in at least one of the home assignments and you do fairly well in the exam, you are able to get the grade of 5. But you have to do really well. Some of you have already asked also about the language of the home assignment. Obviously, you can write the assignment in Finnish for the Finnish students, but you have to be careful in translations of the English terms to the Finnish terms that they are right. So obviously, you should have studied these things already in Finnish, at least a bit, to be able to make the right translations regarding the key terms and definitions. Basically, this is the thing that I wanted to point out. All these other things are there in these exam instructions. So there will be, there already is this folder for the instructions and material for the exams. So there are a couple of articles that I want you to take a very good look at. I should warn you that there are some really very theoretical papers that are actually preliminary theoretical papers, for example, for the part of role of central bank digital currencies. For those papers, try to get the general message. What is the main message in the models? What are the main assumptions? You don't have to do the mathematical derivations of the models. You don't have to give the final results based after the derivations, but you should understand what is the general message. What are the relevant things in terms of the development of the results that the authors get in those articles? So you have to give me an idea that you understand that what are the key sort of takeouts from those papers. If you start doing the derivations of the theoretical papers, the online appendixes are really, 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 really long. So those derivations alone would take all the page load, number of pages in your home assignment. So please don't do that. I've tried to instruct that you don't have to do that. So this is for the exam instructions and also the material by Olli-Pekka Ruuskanen that will be lectured on Friday is included to these lecture materials. So take a look at that too. It is already there in the module. Okay, so are there any questions? Then please also give the feedback of the general conduct of this course and so on. This course is developing every year because the things are changing every year. So perhaps probably already next year, we will be having some more firm results, for example, about the role of central bank digital currencies. And some of the central banks might even already done their choices regarding the form of that currency, but these things could keep on evolving on a yearly basis. So obviously this course also will be changing. So for those of you that are not able to take the full sort of a completion of this course this year, be prepared to the possibility that the contents might change already for the next year, at least a bit, because these things keep on changing. Okay, it has been nice for my part. It has been a pleasure to give this lecture for you. Next year, we have to discuss with the students and other relevant parties whether we will be giving these kind of hybrid lectures again, and will we be recording these things, because I have, at least I have suffered from the lack of participants in in-class sessions. Really seriously, I have seen only 3 regular guys during the last 3 weeks in the lectures. I mean, it's a bit sort of a, it's not so encouraging for the lecturer to go there and only have the 3 guys, even though they are really active and they are really seem to be, have been really interested about these things. I have no doubt that all the others are also interested about these things. And you might have personal reasons not to participate to the in-class, but nevertheless, we will have to discuss about the practical conduct of this course. Okay, so for my part, I thank you for taking the course and wish you all the best luck to the exam, and try to do your best also in the home assignments, because they will have a big role. And let's see each other also on Friday. And the first session will start at 10:15 and use the same Zoom link for the Friday's sessions. Okay, thank you. And have a nice rest of the autumn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.